All right, we're on the air. Wednesday morning Bible study, The Art of Dying. Let's see, week 8 now. We're going to finish up the photocopies of the book I gave you for The Art of Dying. Do you need a copy?
Oh, yeah.
The Art of Dying, this one?
Oh, yes.
You didn't bring that one.
No.
Well, that's my last copy up there. If anybody else needs a copy, I can make more. All right, so The Art of Dying. So if you remember last week, we talked about the fourth temptation that the devil confronts us with. And just by, brief kind of reminder, catch us up. That was on page 68 and 69, the devil's temptation concerning vainglory. If you think of vanity, it's about yourself, and glory, to give yourself glory. So another word for vainglory is pride. And that is a temptation that this unknown monk from the Middle Ages, said is particularly fruitful among Christians. Because what is our tendency, our nature, is to say, well, of course God is going to save me. I've been a faithful Christian all my life. Look at me. I've gone to church. I've tithed. I've volunteered. I've helped. So God is going to save me. Well, the truth is that why God's going to save you?
No.
Why is God going to save you? Because of right there. Because of Jesus. Even though we do good things and we go to church and we tithe and we do all that stuff and that's good, but we still do a lot of sins. So God saves us out of mercy and grace because of Jesus. So that was a temptation that particularly is poignant to God's faithful people. You remember that from last week? Any questions from last week or comments? Okay, let's jump into the next one. So the next one is Temptation of the Devil Concerning Avarice. This is on page 76 and 77 in your photocopy, 76 and 77. So avarice, another word for that might be greed or indulgence, okay? If you look at the little woodcut there, there's the dying man, and what are the demons pointing to? Well, the one near the top is pointing to family and friends, and the other one is pointing to house and home, and look at what's in the house, barrels of probably wine or beer, and then there, below that is a stable with a horse. So things, pointing to things. You'll see as we read through this, I think there's some good insight here. This one is especially pertinent for people who are maybe non-Christians, non-believers, or even Christians, but maybe we're a little weaker in our faith or in our priorities. So, again, short chapters. I'm going to read a good chunk of this, so let me start and we'll talk about it. So on page 77, the fifth temptation of the devil is avarice, which threatens non-religious and secularly minded people to a greater extent. Avarice is the excessive preoccupation with the passing things of this world. Wives and worldly friends, material wealth, and other things they have loved greatly in life. Through these things, the devil especially vexes a person at the point of death, saying, O wretch, soon you will leave behind all the temporal goods you have amassed with the greatest care and effort, even your wife, your children, your kindred, your dearest friends, and all other desirable things of this world. Their companionship could be a great solace for you and an occasion of great good for them. The devil places before the person at the point of death these and similar enticements so that out of love and greed for worldly things, he may turn away from the love of God and his own salvation. Okay? Now we've all can picture or understand this temptation because we want to cling to our stuff. What's that old joke about you never see a U-Haul behind a hearse? Right? You can't take your stuff with you?
Yeah.
That's kind of what this is about, right? So I would include in this also because, this author mentions worldly friends and family and that kind of stuff, dearest friends. I would include in this the desire for fame. So somebody who's on their deathbed, they see death coming, or even earlier than that, this temptation can confront all of us now, and you say, well, how is my name going to be known? How am I going to be remembered through all posterity? I want to be remembered. Well, frankly, who cares? You're going to be in heaven with the saints. That's who remembers you, and that's what's important. So to be concerned with those earthly things like that, of your stuff, part of this class is how to make arrangements for your stuff, right? That's what we've been talking about, and today as well. Tamara will be talking to us some more about estate plans. So as all of you know, Tamara is our guest speaker today. I'll introduce her in just a little bit. So, yes, we get focused on our stuff. And I would say another part of that is, especially maybe for somebody who's a non-believer, they might say, well, I'm going to die anyway, so I might as well go out and indulge in the sinful vices of the world. Uh-huh. Party hardy. I'm dying soon anyway, right? Is that the right attitude?
No,
not at all.
No.
And if you look at this first page here, if you look down at the footnote, he quotes 1 Timothy 6, verses 9 and 10. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare. For the love of money is the root of all evils. Is money itself evil? No. It's the love of money that's evil. When you start focusing and desiring everything to be based on love. All right, let me read a little bit more. For this reason, it must be especially noted that one should take the greatest care not to recall to the dying person's memory his friends, wife, children, riches, and other things of his passing life, except as his spiritual health demands or requires. I only partially agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. There is nothing wrong with reminiscing about your family or friends or the good things of this life. We shouldn't obsess over them. We shouldn't focus on them, especially when you see death approaching. But there's nothing wrong with remembering some of your fond memories of family and friends, okay? So this is partially true, I would say, with what the author says right there. All right, and if you flip the page, it's on page 78. It would be most dangerous, for it would call him back toward those fleeting and worldly anxieties at a time when all his physical and mental faculties must especially focus on things of the Spirit and of salvation. All worldly concerns should be removed from memory and from the mind with the greatest care, since clearly at that time a preoccupation with them is most dangerous. I think that's part of what we're doing in this class. Get your affairs in order, have a plan made, have everything ready, so that when the time comes and you can recognize that God is soon going to call you home, you can put all those earthly matters out of your mind. And just think about God and Jesus' salvation for you and heaven that awaits, those spiritual things. So that you don't have to fret in your mind while you're approaching death about all these earthly matters. Okay? Put them aside. Alright? So I do agree with that. Focus on heaven, not dwelling on earthly matters. And this is, you know, we're talking about the last weeks, months, maybe years of life. All right. The footnote down there at the bottom, number 58. The best support that family and friends can offer at this challenging time is solidarity in prayer and other religious practices, all of which direct attention to things of the Spirit and of salvation. I totally agree with that statement. Best thing you can do with somebody who's approaching life, you know, their health is of such a nature, or the medical community says there's nothing more we can do, or whatever, is just be there. You know, among pastors, we were told this, it's called the ministry of presence. You're just there. You pray with them, maybe you sing, maybe you read some Bible stories. You talk about whatever, nothing in particular. You're just there. Companionship. What is it God said at the very beginning of creation? It is not good for man to be alone. Have companionship. That is a wonderful thing. You hear people about sitting at the bedside of a parent or a grandparent or somebody, you know, sitting by somebody's deathbed. Just help, you know, just being with them. That is a good thing. Okay? All right, so this is a temptation the devil confronts us with. Different people differently, and it may even be before you're approaching death. So then the next part there, good inspiration of the angel against avarice. So if you look at the woodcut there on page 80, there's the dying man again. And what is the angel right in front of him pointing to? Finger is pointing up right at what?
Pointing to
Christ on the cross. Absolutely. That is absolutely right. You focus on Jesus and what he did for you and his love for you and his dying and rising again for you. And there's that demon down in the bottom corner kind of cowering. So, yes, that is absolutely the right approach. All right, let me read a little bit. Against the fifth temptation of the devil, the angel gives good inspiration, saying, O man, turn your ears away from the deadly suggestions of the devil, which he uses to try to provoke and poison you, and place totally behind you all the things of this world, since remembering them surely brings nothing of salvation, but greatly impedes it. Be mindful of the Lord's words to those who cling to these things. Whoever does not renounce all things, whatever he possesses, cannot be my disciple. Jesus said that. And again, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Again, Jesus said that. In turn, to those who renounce these things, he says, and everyone who is left behind, house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands, on account of my name, will receive 100-fold and possess eternal life. Now, a brief little delving into this, because some of you have heard this before from me or other pastors. Jesus does say this, and he says, unless you hate all of them, you can't be part of me and love eternal life. Well, that's a little confusing. Does Jesus want us to hate each other? No. I preached a sermon on this quite a while ago. I did a little study on it. The Greek word for hate is meseo. And meseo, the number one definition of it in the Greek dictionary, is to wish ill of someone. In other words, hate. However, the number two definition of this word in Greek is to love something less than. That's the sense Jesus is using this word here. So it gets translated as hate, which sort of is technically correct. But what Jesus is saying, unless you love me more than your family, you cannot have eternal salvation with me. I'm not a part of you. You need to love me more than others. Frankly, that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem for humanity is, who do we elevate in our love over Jesus?
Ourselves.
Ourselves! We put ourselves over Jesus, and then maybe our family over Jesus, and maybe our friends over Jesus, and Jesus is way down here. Yes, Jesus should be our first love. And then family, and then yourself should be way down here. You know, that's humility. Not thinking about yourself, but thinking about others first, and most especially about Christ first. Okay, so there's a little side note on that, on those couple of verses. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of you maybe remember hearing me say that, or Pastor Q, or somebody else. All right, let me read just a little bit more. Remember also the poverty of Christ hanging on the cross for you, who willingly left behind his most beloved mother and dearest disciples for your salvation. Now, someone last night brought up, the idea about, Jesus was concerned with earthly things while he was dying on the cross. And my response to that is, and I would remind you of this too, he was concerned for his mother. Joseph obviously had already died. So he turned over the necessity of caring for his mother to help her to the beloved disciple. We know that's John, the Apostle John. He turns that over to John so that he can then have that free of his mind. He can, I mean, if you want to say it this way, it's actually true. He can focus on the process of dying. Okay? Mm-hmm. So he turns over those earthly matters. I would say that's what we're doing in this class when we have all these special speakers that we've been having, is getting all of our affairs in order so we can turn that over and we can depart in peace knowing that it's all taken care of. All right? Like Jesus took care of his mother. All right? So that's a good example. Think of that. All right? Make sense? All right. Everybody with me? Not talking too fast? If you think I'm talking too fast, you need to drink more coffee. That way you can listen fast. Caffeine will help you listen fast,
yes.
Right? All right. page. Page 82. The last paragraph there, just at the very beginning. Note that when the sick person perceives he is being tempted by avarice or love of earthly things, he should first consider that this worldly love separates him from God because it excludes the love of God. What's the first commandment? No other gods before me. Right? So God is number one. Jesus is number one. We should not place anything higher in priority. That's what that word hate is really referring to, that may be misunderstood. Let me point for you, pull up for you a particular verse that comes to mind. Is it on the screen? No, I gotta get this going here. Okay, duplicate. All right. So this is going to be 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 to 7. All right, so a little, what I'll call Lutheranizing here. Kind of pointing you to kind of what we would say and believe. All right, so this is Peter in his first epistle, verse 6, right there on the screen. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. If you're ever tempted by avarice or love of earthly things or to indulge in earthly matters, what does this remind us? What's the most valuable thing you own? It's not your house. It's not your car. It's not your boat.
It's our faith.
It's not your pension plan. It's not your retirement account. The most valuable thing you own is your faith. More precious than gold. That's the most valuable thing, and that will last forever, and no one can take that from you. Okay? So there is a wonderful verse to remember if you're ever tempted, find yourself tempted by earthly matters. Okay? Pause for a minute so I can drink some more coffee and caffeinate.
I think we always have to remember, though, that even though no one can take it with us, we can lose it.
We can reject it, yes. That's the danger, that we reject our faith. The devil can't take it from us, but we can let go of it. Yeah. There's a great sermon coming up this coming Sunday about that.
Oh, there is.
If you want to pay attention.
Spoilers?
Yeah. No, I didn't spoil anything about it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, we're going to finish this book. So, conclusion, it's just a couple pages. So, on page 85, so the conclusion of this book, if the suffering person can speak and use his mental faculties, let him pour forth prayers to God. First, he should beg the Lord that through his ineffable mercy and power of his passion, he may deign to receive him. Yes, that is good advice. When we're approaching death, just pour forth in prayer. Be in prayer with God. And, you just throw yourself on his mercy. Some of you may remember, I don't know, I think I've said it a few times, probably Pastor Q as well, What is known to be Luther's last words when he died? Anybody recall?
Oh, Don? We are beggars.
We are just
yes.
Beggars.
It is true, we are beggars. That's what Luther said. We are all beggars. None of us earn it. None of us deserve it. We just beg God for mercy. And guess what? As soon as you ask God for mercy, what does he give you? Mercy. And he saves you. There you go. And I was about to say, my second favorite prayer, I think the second best prayer, you've heard me say this over and over again, the Kyrie. Lord have mercy. What a great prayer. We pray it in church all the time. Pray it on your deathbed. Lord have mercy. And then you say the Lord's Prayer. That's the greatest prayer, is the Lord's Prayer. Do you realize, we say the Kyrie and the Lord's Prayer all the time, we talk about heaven all the time in church. What is church doing? Preparing you for death. That's the whole point of church. Not the whole point, but, the main purpose.
The main purpose, right.
You're baptized. Why? You're baptized. All of us, I think, were probably baptized as infants, in the Lutheran church. You're baptized as a baby for your death. To prepare you for death. To go through death and come out the other side in heaven. That's the point of church. Yes, there's more points to church. We should love and serve our neighbor, and we should, you know, do all of that kind of stuff too. But it's all about Jesus and what he does for us. Okay? Now back to the reading here, page 85. Second, he should earnestly invoke the glorious Virgin Mary as his own mediatrix. No. This is a Catholic monk in the Middle Ages writing this. And so he goes on to talk about praying the rosary and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So he's right. Whoever wrote this, nobody knows. We would agree with him, yes. When you're approaching death, one of the best things you can do is just be in prayer with God. Mm-hmm. But not the rosary. Mary is not a god. She's a saint, yes, we should honor her, we should uplift her. She was faithful, wonderful. But she's not God. She can't hear your prayers. She's up in heaven, enjoying the peace of heaven. So no, the answer is yes, pray, but not the rosary. Okay. All right, turn the page. So the end of that top paragraph on page 86. But if the sick person does not know the prayers to say, someone attending to him should say the prayers aloud in his presence, or read to him devout stories he enjoyed when he was well. Let him pray in his heart and with longing as he knows and is able. Yes, again, if you're accompanying somebody, you're just being a companion while they're approaching death, you can pray with them, pray for them, pray out loud. That's the best thing to do. That's what I do when I visit somebody who, you know, it's known, you know, a hospice or whoever says, you know, it's a matter of weeks or whatever. Okay, I sit there and I'll read to them, I'll pray to them. You can do the same thing. Let me give you some suggestions. A couple of suggestions for prayers. Yes, the Lord's Prayer and the Kyrie. Along with that, the Apostles' Creed. Even if somebody is losing a little bit of, you know, mental acuity, they're still going to know the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed. I've seen that over and over again. You've heard this from me and other pastors. I would also say you could pray with somebody Psalm 27, Psalm 31. Jesus prayed Psalm 31 from the cross. Into your hands I commit my spirit. He prayed that one. You can also pray Psalm 23. So many people know that one by heart, most of us. What a wonderful psalm. You can also pray Psalm 121. And then, yes, I would say, even if you're by yourself, you have a hymnal or a hymn memorized, sing a hymn. My wife and I picked this up from a pastor at the seminary. When our kids were little, we would sing them various songs to get them to go to sleep. And yes, we would pray Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, and we'd sing the ABC song and that. But among those, we would also sing this song. This hymn, Lord Jesus, think on me. It's a very comforting hymn, and it points us to heaven. And I'm proud to say that all my kids now recognize it. I think they've got it memorized, because there were a few times where I would reverse a couple of the stanzas. Dad, that's not the right order. You sang it out of order. Oh, yeah, you're right, I did. Sing a hymn to somebody, a loved one, or to yourself. Pray, sing a hymn, and then what's the other thing he says there? Read favorite Bible stories. Absolutely. Read some Bible stories. Those are all good things to do. And notice what all that does is focus you on heaven, not on earthly matters. Right? All right. One last suggestion, and then I'll wrap it up. Oh, I'm over. So we're going to give Tamara bonus time because I ran over. I'm trying to be done in half an hour, okay? Another thing to remind you of is this. Remember we talked about this a number of weeks ago, Commendation of the Dying?
Yes.
This is chock full of prayers. There's the Litany of the Dying in here, which you could read to yourself or to a loved one. There's all kinds of stories, you know, Bible passages right in the middle. You could read some or all of those. So this is a good resource too. Remember this, okay? Commendation of the Dying. All right. Briefly, time for a question or two, if there are any. Comment? Janet, are you thinking, or you're going to ask a question?
I said all the wrong things yesterday when I went to the visitor's shed. What I should have done is, and it occurred to me last night, was sing some of the songs of when we were in school, some of the, you know, in, or in Sunday school, or some of our Christian childhood songs.
Sure.
Go back and do it again.
Yeah, go back and do it again, right, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so next week, we have our last guest speaker will be a lady from hospice, the local hospice here. She's going to explain to us what hospice is and what they do, and it's some people have a misconception about it. And we're going to also start and go through these two books. We're going to go through this one first, Christian Care at Life's End. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to hit some highlights in here. And then the week after that, we'll go through this book. So these two books are about taking care of somebody at life's end. What would we consider ethically or scripturally allowable and not in terms of like medical directives? Okay? So that's kind of what we're going to talk about next week and the week after. Those will be our last 2 weeks and then the class will be done for the summer. Okay? So with that, I want to bring up Tamara Paulin. Most of you already know her. One of our own, a member here. Yay, how wonderful. She's chairman of the school board right now. Are you still going to be or is somebody else taking?
Two more years.
All right, good. Well, and here's the wonderful thing. She's a trust attorney. So if you remember Julie Burgess from the foundation at CEF, yep. Julie kind of gave us an introduction and why you need an estate plan. And one of the free services that CEF offers is that either Julie or one of her compatriots can come out and review your specific situation with you. Sit down at the kitchen table and say, okay, here's the documents you need, and they can give you some boilerplate, and so it's easier when you go to an attorney. Well, Tamara's going to delve a little bit more into those details and explain to us a little bit more about powers of attorney and living wills and irrevocable trusts and all that kind of stuff, okay? So you're going to get a little deeper education today about all those matters, all right? Thank you, Tamara.
Sure, thank you. So what Pastor said is exactly right. Doing all of these things helps you to put your mind at ease and focus on the important things. I can tell you from drafting documents and working with families to get some of these things in order, I have seen it, so it's real. When people come in and get their estate plans completed, you can almost see a visible lift of the weight coming off their shoulders because they finally got this taken care of, because it's one of those things that's really easy to kick that can down the road, but once you actually do it, it really does free your mind and provide some relief. So I would encourage everyone to do that because it is worth it, and it does provide, you know, clarity and you know, you can focus on what you need to focus on. So, as Pastor said, I'm the school board lady. I'm also a mom to Amelia and Hadley, who are in second and fifth grade, respectively, here at Christ Lutheran. Married to John, you've probably seen working around the building as well. I went to Hillsdale College, which is where John and I met. From there, we went back to Chicago, which is where I grew up. I went to John Marshall Law School, which is now part of University of Illinois, and practiced in private practice for about 10 years in the Chicago area, mostly on estate planning and probate administration work, before I was recruited out to this side of the lake, which we love. It's so much better here.
yes.
But I was recruited by First Source Bank to run their St. Joe trust office, and then about 2 years ago I was recruited by KeyBank to work with their team in South Bend. So we do not have local offices, so I do a lot of driving back and forth to South Bend. But I love what I do because I get to work with families kind of on the other side, so I'm not drafting documents for people anymore. Where I step in is I provide guidance when they're going through the process with their attorney, but I also step in as the trustee or the personal representative when someone does pass away to follow the instructions that they've provided and to administer things to their wishes for their family and loved ones that they've left behind. So that's kind of what I do from a professional standpoint. Also have a lot of personal experience in this arena because I've had some family members pass away. I lost both my parents in 2020, lost my sister in 2022. So I've seen both sides of it. I've seen the technical legal side of it. I've also experienced the personal side of it. So, you know, I'm here to share whatever I can and be a resource. So, moving on, I think you covered a lot of this, so I'm going to kind of go quickly through the first few slides, but if you have any questions, please stop me. It's a lot more interesting if you ask questions instead of me just talking. So the state plan, in its simplest form, is a collection of documents that tells what you want to happen when you pass away or become incapacitated. And I want to stress the incapacity part, because a lot of people, when they think of an estate plan, they only think of when I die. Yes, that's important, but the demographics and the fact that we're living longer these days, thanks to medical innovations and things, it also means we're more likely to suffer incapacity or loss of our faculties towards the end of life. So this is becoming more and more important to make sure you've got both the pre-death as well as the post-death, excuse me, kind of taken care of. So we'll go through what documents those are, cover both of those. I think Julie covered most of these, so I'm not going to go through them all, but those are why I think an estate plan is important. Number five, I think, is the most important. This is what you can avoid. So we talked a little bit last night about guardianship, and that would be that incapacity period that I talked about. So if someone does lose their capacity, whether it's dementia, Alzheimer's, you're in a coma, any of those things, in order for a family member to make legal or medical decisions for you, if you don't have powers of attorney, they would need to go through a guardianship proceeding in court. So it's best to avoid that. It's already a stressful time. They don't need that. So that's why you do these things.
So, Tamara,
yes.
If you don't have the powers of attorney, I know you're going to talk about that here in a few slides. If you don't have the powers of attorney and you're in a coma, who makes decisions for you while you wait for the court to declare you as the guardian?
Financially, typically everything just has to wait. In my experience, medically, the medical professionals will turn to the next of kin and generally accept that.
Even though it's not yet been declared by the court?
Yes, but they're not required to.
So it could be a case where a hospital or a doctor will just do what they think.
Correct.
Regardless of what you, the next of kin, want, because you haven't been declared guardian.
Correct.
Okay.
So you're in a gray area there,
and
you don't want to go there.
Yeah, right.
So yes. And then these are the benefits of why you do an estate plan for after-death purposes. So, again, these things can be avoided by just some planning.
You want to mention that $28,000 cap, because you mentioned that last night.
Yes. So there are different ways, obviously, to do your estate planning. And this $28,000 number, it's set by statute. It's adjusted every year for inflation. If you die owning $28,000, that's this year, $28,000 or less in individually titled assets, your estate will not go through probate. That's kind of like the freebie. So what would happen is your next of kin, if your assets, your combined assets individually owned total less than $28,000, they will fill out what is called a small estate affidavit, and they will present that to your bank or your credit union, and that will allow them to gather those assets and distribute them without going to court. However, if you're over that amount, or if you have real estate that's in your individual name, cars that are worth more than that, that's when you're going to get into probate. So, probate versus non-probate assets. So probate assets are those assets that will go through the probate process. They pass through your estate. Those are assets that are individually titled. That means you don't have a joint owner on them. It means you don't have a beneficiary or a transfer on death associated with those assets. Non-probate assets are all those things that transfer outside of your estate. Any questions there? That's kind of a strange legal construct.
I guess I'm confused about it.
Sure. So probate assets, if I have a checking account and I'm the only one on it, it's my sole account, and I die, that's a probate asset. If I have a joint account with my husband and I die, that's a non-probate asset because it transfers automatically to my husband at my death. Another example, if I have an IRA and I have a beneficiary listed, non-probate asset because it transfers automatically according to that beneficiary designation.
And you said, and I think Julie might have said this too, if you have to go through probate, it's not like the end of the world. It's just that probate takes time and it takes money. You have to go through the court.
Correct.
And it ties up your stuff. So if you can have an appropriate will or trust,
right,
you can avoid probate and everything can become non-probate. So then your estate is distributed more quickly and efficiently and at less cost.
Correct. So yes, I think I did say that last night. It's not the end of the world. So if someone's estate goes through probate, it is not the end of the world. It just means there's going to be some delays because there are some statutory time periods you have to wait to have lapse before you can make distributions. You have to get court approval for certain things like that. So it's all going to be fine, but you can avoid it. And if you can avoid it, you should try to. So a lot of attorneys will use that as kind of a scare tactic. Oh, you have to get this done. You're going to go through probate. Yeah. But it's still going to be fine. It's just going to take longer and be a little more expensive. So this is just kind of some of the practical reasons as to why you want to do this. Okay, so now we're going to get into the documents. So we've got our pre-death documents and our post-death documents. Financial power of attorney is a pre-death document. It actually stops being valid at death. So, financial power of attorney is created by statute. There is a sample form in the statute that you can use. You do have to have two non-named witnesses sign the document as well as the principal. The principal is the person creating the power of attorney. The agent are the people that they name to make decisions for them. So, as the name implies, financial power of attorney allows you to name someone to make financial decisions on your behalf. And that avoids that guardianship proceeding that we talked about earlier. There are two types of financial powers of attorney. There's a durable and a springing power of attorney. Durable power of attorney becomes effective the moment it is fully executed. So whether or not you're incapacitated, that agent that you've named can go out and make financial transactions on your behalf and in your name. Springing power of attorney requires incapacity. An incapacity and proof of incapacity is defined in the document. So it could be your doctor must give a written statement that you're incapacitated. It could be that the majority of your children have to state that you are incapacitated. Whatever you're comfortable with, you put that in the document. And then once that is triggered, that's when the power of attorney becomes effective. I will caution with springing powers of attorney, it can sometimes be cumbersome to get those triggers. Doctors are hesitant to sign a statement saying someone's incapacitated for liability reasons. So but those are the two types. I would say it's an often overlooked document, and the decision of who to name is often just kind of an afterthought because it's kind of one of the minor documents. But you are giving legal power to whomever you name to make decisions and transact on your behalf. So be very careful who you name. Make sure you trust that person. And as far as durable versus springing, my preference is for durable because I've seen situations where it's hard to get that springing provision to toggle on. And if you're naming someone to make decisions on your behalf and you don't trust them to do it now, why do you think they're going to do a better job once you're incapacitated? So that's just my personal commentary on that.
Yes. But a durable, you would need to make sure if it's one of your kids, say, or a relative, you trust them now because the moment it's signed, they can start manipulating your finances.
Correct.
Even though you're still fine and alive and yep. and have capacity.
Absolutely.
So it has to be somebody you trust.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
But you can give that person that some instructions so they follow it. You can have that written in there too, correct?
Absolutely. And when they are acting under this document, they are what is called a fiduciary, which means they owe you the highest legal duty of care. So if they breach that, there is legal recourse, but who wants to deal with that? Yes?
I've noticed, and of course in the paper and everything, is a notice of probate. Mm-hmm. How long does that have to run, you know, after the person dies?
That is the creditor notice, and that is one of those things that you get to avoid if you don't go through probate. So I believe in Michigan it's 6 months it has to run.
Ooh.
Some states are 9. So that means no distributions can be made because the personal representative who's handling all the affairs, administering the estate, has to make sure there are no creditor claims out there because they get paid first before the beneficiaries get anything. So they have to sit around and wait for someone to pop up and say, I'm owed money from this estate. Yeah?
They also have to publish for possible
heirs.
Not creditors. But
heirs. Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct. And as I mentioned, this document loses its effectiveness at death. Yes?
How long after that 6 months do they still have the ability to come back in?
That is a hard and fast deadline. They do not.
As long as,
correct, as long as the requirement, the statutory requirements of publishing were followed to the T, that 6 months is a hard and fast cutoff. So if someone comes at 6 months and one day, too bad. So there are situations where you actually want to go through probate. If you think there are a lot of creditors out there, the attorney would advise you to go through probate so that you can cut that off. That's a unique situation. Healthcare power of attorney, very similar, except obviously it deals with healthcare decisions. So also set by statute, also a sample document in the statute, and also needs two non-named witnesses. A lot of people, if they're doing them on their own, will go to their bank and have bank employees witness, just as a practical tip. Again, you're the principal, you're naming agents to act on your behalf to make guardianship, or healthcare decisions. It avoids guardianship. And again, it ends at the principal's death. And since it ends at death, you should include in that document provisions for the disposition of your remains if you have specific wishes as to how you want that handled. That should be in that document. Yes?
And so these can be different people or the same person?
Good point. They can absolutely be different people, and oftentimes they should, because a lot of times someone that has a very good financial acumen, maybe not so much on the healthcare side or on the compassion side. They're just different skill sets. So yes, you can absolutely name different people, but you can name the same if you want. Most often I will see spouses name each other, and then I recommend after the spouse having two people in each document, so a total of three, a bench of three deep in each document, because we just don't know what's going to happen. There could be deaths in short succession. So you don't get into the attorney's office to update it after a spouse passes. And then what if your second person is out of the country or unable or unwilling for whatever reason to act? Then you've at least got that kind of stopgap person in there. You can always change these. As long as you have capacity, all of these can be amended and changed. But if you've got them in there, at least you've got protection. So any questions on that one? Yes, Nate.
I have a question. A friend of mine has a will and do trust.
Yep.
Is that necessary?
In some situations, it is advisable, yes.
Would a trust take precedent over a will?
Not precedence. They do different things, and I will talk about that in just a minute. If I don't answer your question, please raise your hand again, because we're going to talk about trusts next. Yes.
Yes, I'm assuming that the mortuary or whatever can advise you too, but are there places in the state of Michigan where you cannot deposit remains? Or, you know, there are strict laws out there.
There are, and I will admit I am not terribly familiar with them.
Uh-huh. But there are laws.
Yes.
That was a question I think Starks maybe addressed a little bit way back when they came in and talked about pre-planning your funeral. Yes, there are laws about distributing. If you're cremated and you want your remains sprinkled here or there, you can't just do it whatever you want. There are some regulations about that.
Yes, so, yeah. You can't sprinkle them at Disney World or the Disney Field, but I will tell you people do it all the time.
Yes, right.
So, the legal of the
boy.
Yeah. And I forgot to mention on the financial power of attorney, just a practical tip. Once you get it drafted, signed, all that good stuff, take it to your bank or your credit union, your financial institution, wherever you have your investments. Give them a copy. Tell them you want their legal department to review it, and then that you want to put it on your record or on your account, because some banks and some institutions can be real sticklers about them, and you don't want to find out that they're going to reject your power of attorney because it's too old or because it doesn't contain certain provisions. Once you're incapacitated and your agent needs to rely on it. So get it taken care of in advance, make sure they review it and approve it in advance and get it on file. Same thing with your healthcare power of attorney. It's not that they're going to be rejected, but just give it to your healthcare providers so that they've got it on file. So when something would happen, you know, when your son or daughter calls in or comes in, they already have it, and your agent isn't scrambling to try to find the paperwork. Just
you're,
makes things.
You're saying banks can be sticklers?
They can. They can.
For a bank.
I do. But I'm sharing this tip. We all have bosses. I apologize. I've got one more before we get to the trusts. The living will is just, it's also called a declaration or advance directive. It will outline your wishes or your desires regarding extraordinary measures, feeding tube, cardiac resuscitation, breathing tube, that kind of thing. So also share that with your healthcare power of attorney and with your medical providers so that they have it on record.
So when a living will or advance directive, that be connected to the healthcare power of attorney?
They're two separate documents, but yes, they...
But whoever you designate as your healthcare power of attorney to make those kinds of decisions should have this also and be aware of your wishes.
Correct. And one thing I will say, I might have it later, but yes, one other tip is talk to the people you name in these documents. Don't just name people and assume that they're okay with it, number one, or that they know what you want, number two. Especially as it comes to the financial power of attorney, tell them what you want. Tell them, you know, be as specific as you can. Yes, this is going to be a very, very hard conversation, but tell them what you want, because I can promise you it is going to be so much easier for them when that time comes to make that decision. If they know all they're doing is carrying out your wishes and what you told them to do, as opposed to having to sit there and try to make that decision themselves and figure out what you would want. It causes so much more stress in that latter situation. So do that for whoever you name. Have those conversations. Tell them what you want. And that's my preaching on that one. And here we go. The living trust, it goes by many names. Living trust, revocable trust, grantor trust, they are all the same thing. What it means is it is a document that can be changed while you are alive and have capacity. While you are alive, it functions as your alter ego. It uses your same social security number, so there are no crazy tax implications or anything like that. What it does, though, is I like to describe it as an envelope. You have this envelope as you go through life where you put all your stuff, right? All the stuff you own is in this envelope. Right now, if you don't have a trust, your envelope says Tamara Paula, because everything's in my individual name. Once I draft a trust and fund the trust, so put all the assets in the trust, it's going to say the Tamara Paula Living Trust. And then all those assets are being retitled into the name of the trust. Also in that envelope is the trust document, which provides all the instructions for what the successor trustee is supposed to do with those assets when I die. And because all of your assets are in that document with the trust instructions, with the successor named, when I become incapacitated or die, that envelope just transfers to the next person without going through probate. They pick up, they take out the instructions, and they go to work doing what I've told them to do. So that is why a trust is important if you're over that $28,000 threshold, and avoiding probate is important to you. In this document, I also recommend naming multiple successors, so, you know, if the next person in line isn't able. Let's see, after you pass away, when that envelope passes to the successor will obtain a new tax ID number for that trust, because it becomes then its own legal entity. That's how it gets around probate. So it goes from using your social security number to using this new tax ID, and that's how it skips probate. While you're alive, you can do anything you want with that envelope. You can take assets out, you can put assets in, you can change the instructions, you can completely tear them up, you can just make little minor tweaks. As long as you're alive and have capacity, you are in control of that envelope. And then once you pass away, those instructions will be carried out by your successor trustee.
I like your illustration of an envelope. That's an excellent way to think of it, that you put all your assets in there. So, and then I don't know that you mentioned it. Maybe is it the next slide that you have to fund it, meaning
So you have to fund it. So you have to get those assets. This is now the trust envelopes. You have to put the assets into the trust. Otherwise, the trust doesn't work. So that is a step. It's later in the slide sheet, but that's a step a lot of attorneys don't assist with or stress enough. They will send you off with this binder, and there's somewhere in the back of it an instruction sheet of how to fund the trust, but most of them don't get funded. And so you've just paid a lot of money for this binder that's not going to actually do what you set out to have it do. Yes?
So if you have, say, IRAs in your name and your wife's name, mm-hmm. would those all need to be transferred into the trust then?
So, yes.
I mean, obviously we have things that we own jointly, but
right.
also own things separately.
That's a really good question. IRAs are kind of a unique situation because they're an individual retirement account. Mm-hmm. They cannot be owned by the trust. They have to be owned by the individual. And because of the unique tax situation that IRAs are in, it's often advisable to name the spouse as the primary beneficiary and then potentially name the trust as the successor beneficiary. Because the spouse gets to treat that IRA as their own, which means they get to stretch out the distributions for longer than just an ordinary beneficiary would. So IRAs are a little bit unique, but like if you have just an investment account, it's not an IRA, yes, you'd want to put that into the trust
okay,
or house.
So bank accounts, investment accounts, mm-hmm. Real estate.
Correct. Yes.
Would need to be put in the trust.
Correct.
Okay.
Generally, vehicles are not recommended to go into trust unless it's like an antique or some, you know, like very expensive car, because insurance companies struggle with that. They don't know how to rate a trust because it doesn't have a driving record. So just practical tip. Generally, cars stay out of the trust. So, Faith, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
okay.
You have to go through the effort of contacting all those institutions and renaming the okay. assets in the name of the trust.
Correct. And it's a project. But all of the institutions have done it before. This is not new to any of them. So it's just they're going to send you forms, paperwork you're going to have to fill out. They may ask for a copy of the trust. And then what will happen is all your statements, instead of saying Tamara Pollen, it's going to say Tamara Pollen Living Trust. So I still own it. I'm still in control of it, but it's got that trust name on there, so I know it's in the trust.
Can you have a joint trust?
Yes. Yes, that's a very good point. Yes, you can, and most folks do.
Okay.
Because the estate exemption, the lifetime gift and estate exemption is so high these days, currently we're over $12 million per person. We'll sunset at the end of 2025, but it's still likely to be in the $6 to $7 million range. So if you have assets less than $6 to $7 million a person, you can absolutely do a joint trust for a husband and a wife.
Not a problem for you, how about?
And then the last post-death document we'll talk about, and I actually failed to mention, the trust is actually, it straddles the line, because if you're incapacitated, it does kick in, because your successor trustee, if you've got a joint trust, it'll be your spouse most likely, your successor trustee will step in and be able to manage things. But then it also continues over into death, so it straddles the line of both pre- and post-death documents. Will is definitely a post-death document. If you do not have a trust, your will govern how your assets are distributed. If you have a trust, what your will most likely be is a pour-over will, which means it's just going to take any of those assets you forgot to put into the envelope and dump them in there. It may, those assets, depending on the value, may or may not have to go to the probate to get into that envelope. But that's what your will does, is it says, I want everything to go into the trust and be distributed according to those provisions. Wills are also created by statute. It has to be in writing, signed by the testator, which is the person making the will, as well as two witnesses. When a person passes away, the will be filed with the clerk of court. If probate is required, you have to prove up the will. If not, you don't have to prove it up. And if you have minor children, the will is the document where you can appoint a guardian to take care of them if you were to pass away.
Probably not an issue for any of us here.
But your kids, you know, that if you've got grandkids, make sure their parents, your children, have a will. Because if they don't, and something were to happen to both parents, a judge is going to be the one making the decision who raises those kids. So, which actually might be on my next slide.
So would you would you need an attorney to do that? For, guardianship over minor children?
Technically, no. you can do one yourself, but to make sure that you actually meet all the legal formalities and everything, it is recommended. There's a reason we go to school and carry malpractice insurance like doctors do. So, who needs an estate plan? I argue that everyone over 18 needs to think about this. Because at 18, your parents are no longer able to access your or help you on your financial affairs. They cannot make medical decisions for you. Whenever I have clients in and they have kids going off to college in the fall, and I'm sending them to get their estate plans done, I say, also, bring your son or daughter with, have them get at least powers of attorney done so that you're covered if something unfortunate were to happen. And then I know we talked about a lot of things, and trusts are, complicated. They can get far more complicated as the estate size and things grow, but there are simple plans, but I will say they all require planning. So whatever you're going to do, you do have to plan. You can get around things without using a trust, but you still have to plan. So, just other comments. We talked about it. Don't forget to fund your trust. That is, if you're getting a trust, that is first and foremost to get done. Kind of talked about it earlier. Share your documents with people that you put in there. Give them a copy. If they're next in line, give them a copy so that if they're called upon to act, they don't have to go to your house and try to find that binder in an already stressful situation. As far as updating and reviewing your plan, the laws are constantly changing, both the statutes and the tax laws. So it is not a one and done, unfortunately. I would say at a minimum every 5 to 10 years, pull it out, look at it, make sure the people you've listed to act are still in your life. Make sure, nothing has changed with your beneficiaries such that you need to change how they're getting their money. Is there a gambling problem? Do they have a creditor problem? Well, that requires you to change things. And those things develop, over a period of years. Get in there sooner. Look at it sooner if you've got a birth, a death, or a divorce. Don't wait for the five-year mark if someone gets divorced. Look at it then. And in doing this, if you have an attorney, it should just require a call to their office. Hey, so-and-so just had a baby. Do I need to do anything different with my estate plan? And they should be able to tell you yes or no. Last point, we kind of touched on this also, but really choose your successors and your agents wisely. As we talked about, they need to be trustworthy because they're going to be acting in your stead. Make sure they're competent. Just because someone is good at one thing doesn't mean that they're cut out for this job. There are a lot of tax and legal issues that need to be handled, so make sure this is something they're up to be able to do. Lastly, this is kind of really practical, but do they have the time? Do they have three kids already? Three kids at home under the age of 5 and a full-time job. They probably don't have time to be dealing with this, so it might make sense to look for someone else. Also, are they local? People are moving around a lot more. If you live here, only son's in California, are they going to have the time or the ability or the desire to come back here to, clean out a house, hold an estate sale, deal with trying to sell the house, right? Those are all practical kind of realities that need to be thought about when you're picking these people that you're going to list in the documents. Yes?
Have you seen cases where, multiple kids and, mom and dad name one person the agent, and then it causes, well, mom picked me, dad picked me, so I'm going to make decisions. Well, what about, and actually, I think you said last night, and I've seen this also in my own family structure, it's not necessarily an honor to be picked as the agent because there is a lot of work involved.
There's a lot of work involved in that. It's not an honor at all. It is not an honor. It is a job, and it is an often thankless and unpaid job. So think about that.
And all your siblings are mad at you.
Yes. If you were the one that is named, you were going to have a target on your back. It's just the way it is. So that's why I do what I do now, though, is I step in. I'm a corporate fiduciary, so I am that trustee for the family or that representative that, that administers the estate. So if there are issues that you know are going to come up, I mean, some, you know, right? Like, so many families, you know if there are going to be problems. Sometimes you can't foresee them. Most of the time you can. So if you're really seriously thinking about these things and you know that there are going to be problems, think about a corporate fiduciary, because that puts a neutral third party with no vested interest in the hot seat, and it takes the heat off of your kids. It allows them to maintain their relationships and be mad at me instead, or so someone that, like me.
That's what you do now. Is
correct.
So somebody would name you as the agent and none of the kids as agents. Then you get paid out of the estate. Is that
correct? It would, yes. So,
you get a portion or a designated amount that whatever's determined.
Correct.
But then you're the one everybody's mad at, and the kids can still get along.
Correct. And it would be the institution, not like it's not the individual.
Right.
But
right,
yes.
Right, right.
Yes. So okay. You know, when it makes sense, that it is a really nice option, because again, you don't want to leave behind this kind of your legacy. I hate to say it that way, but you know, tension and fights and kids that don't speak anymore.
In order to name you as a corporate fiduciary, do we have to bank at your bank?
No.
Oh, I was not expecting that answer.
We do have minimum estate sizes,
okay.
And any corporate fiduciary will have those as well, and they vary
okay.
depending on the institution.
So. Does the executor get a fee off the top or whatever?
Corporate fiduciaries do. If you name a son or a daughter, they can. Most of them will not take it.
Okay.
But they can. And the reason a lot of them don't take it is because they already have that target on their back. And if when they give their final accounting to their siblings, they've taken a chunk for themselves, it's not going to go over well. So they put all these hours in, and I guarantee you it's many, many hours,
yeah.
And they're probably not going to get anything for it. The pastor made a point last night of saying, well, can I specify that they're going to get paid? And yes, you can. But just, I would be very specific. If you're naming one child, I'd be very specific. They're going to get, you know, $15 an hour paid, you know, so at least then that child has something to rely on, because the document is otherwise just generally going to say a reasonable fee. And so that's open to interpretation and can cause issues. So, yes.
On the first point, don't forget to fund your trust. Does that mean to rename the assets?
That yep.
Is the point?
Exactly right. Yes. Oh, and then the back. This is just. I'm not going to go through this, but these are just two examples. Kind of depicts in a diagram form what an estate looks like without a trust. And then with a trust. So it kind of outlines kind of what passes outside the estate. And so it's just something for you to look at, really, in a different way of explaining it.
Those are a couple of charts that Tamara put together. And if some of you have a copy of her presentation that's very small. So a couple of people last night said, Pastor, we can't read this and we can't see that on the screen. So I ran full-size copies of these two charts that she has right here. So if anybody wants a full-size copy to look at, Tamara's charts, one is without probate and one is with probate, right?
Correct.
So you can just kind of look through it. So if you want them, I'll leave them right up here at the front.
Thank you for doing that. That's it? Yes?
So the process is, first you need an estate plan.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a lawyer do a will for you, should he have suggested that you do an estate plan?
A will is part of your estate plan. So a will is one of those documents that's in the estate plan.
Okay, so you're saying the estate plan is the documents that
it's
we
all those documents.
All
yep.
Documents.
All those documents okay. We talked about. Yep.
So I didn't know if there was a separate thing you needed to do
nope.
As an estate plan.
Nope, that is yep, the powers of attorney, the living will, the trust if you have one, and then your will. Those are the estate
plan.
Yep. Yep. Yes.
Have you found, you know, a lot of these documents are available on the internet for you, right? Have you found that those are pretty reliable documents? Or for the state of Michigan and the government.
Right.
Yeah.
So Estate documents are state specific. I will say that number one.
Oh, okay.
Most of the documents you're going to find online are not going to be state specific. And I would compare your online free documents or low cost documents to kind of like WebMD. So you're not going to go to WebMD if your arm is gushing blood. I would argue you shouldn't go to, you know, LegalZoom for your estate plan. I think it's a cost that is well worth it. Again, you know, just similar to doctors, we go to a lot of school. We carry really high malpractice insurance because it's complex, and because when something goes wrong, it can go really wrong. So that's just my thought. I will say I'm not practicing anymore, so I have nothing to sell. There are situations where it's not needed. If there are assets like under $28,000, it's probably not needed. But you do want to make sure you have those powers of attorney done correctly, even if nothing else. And attorneys will adjust their pricing depending on the complexity. So, you know, the powers of attorney and will only is going to be a lot cheaper, a lot less expensive than the comprehensive plan with a trust. And I will also say that most attorneys will do an estate plan on a fixed fee basis. So they will meet with you, talk about what your assets are, what your desires are. They will get an idea of what they recommend, and they will be able to give you a fee. So it's I think it's one of the better practice areas because it's a lot more transparent. So they will quote you a fee, and it might be a range. It might be, you know, a couple hundred dollars, depending on, you know, what they find when they really get in there. But they will generally give you a fixed amount that they will charge you. So, you know, I think that's a better way to do business than to say, well, I charge $350 an hour. Okay, well, how many hours is it going to take? Oh, I don't know. So that's just another practical.
Is that the going rate for attorneys, $350 an hour?
Depends on the location.
Wow.
So big city.
I guess I'm in the wrong business.
Yeah.
I would suggest if anybody wants a place to start, talk to Julie Burgess from CEF or one of her compatriots to start with her. Because for free, as a free service to LCMS members, she'll come out and meet with you and look at your individual situation, tell you what documents to have, give you some boilerplate, and then you go to an attorney. And you'll save money because you'll already have a lot of the documents assembled and you'll already know what you want. So it's less time for the attorney. Tamara's not selling anything. She works for the bank. She's a fiduciary, like she said. Although, you know, stick around and answer questions. And if we see you after church, we can ask questions.
Absolutely. I got into this business to help people, so that is nothing makes me happier.
Very good. Wonderful. Well, thank you, Tamara. That was excellent. All right, so next week, with 2 more weeks, the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about end-of-life matters, ethical issues with end-of-life decisions and advance directives. We'll go through those two booklets that I've got up there in the corner, and we'll have a guest speaker next week from hospice to talk about what hospice is and what it does, okay? Let's rise, and if you're able, rise, and we'll close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a good day.